This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Morning Star, Midnight Sun, the early Guadalcanal Solomon's Campaign of World War II, August-October 1942, by Jeffrey R. Cox, narrated by Joe Barrett. Prologue. Visitors. As light started taking over the eastern sky on the morning of August 7, 1942, the officers and men of the Imperial Japanese Navy's 13th Construction Unit began to rouse themselves. Their commander, Captain Monzen Kanae, knew it was going to be a hot day, as days here on the island the Japanese called Garuru Kanaru always were, and a busy day. He was expecting visitors. A month earlier, Captain Monzen's 13th Construction Unit, joined by the 11th Construction Unit under Lieutenant Commander Okamura Tokunaga, had been sent down to this island in the southernmost corner of the Empire of Japan, or more accurately, the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. That was what the Japanese called their empire, though this island was neither in Asia nor blessed with prosperity. Captain Monzen was in a land as alien to him as Tokyo Bay was to Commodore Matthew Perry when he barged in, literally, in 1853, and started the dominoes falling, the first of which was called the Meiji Restoration, and with it the creation of the Japanese Empire. The foundation of the Meiji Restoration was Japan's desire to establish itself as a great power, so that nothing like the humiliation of the Commodore Perry visit could ever happen again. And in establishing itself as a great power, Japan put itself on a collision course with other great powers. It was most fortunate for Japan that its first European rival for control of Asia was the most inept of the great powers, Tsarist Russia. The combined fleet of the Imperial Japanese Navy destroyed the Russian Far East fleet off Port Arthur. The Tsar sent his Baltic fleet halfway around the world to relieve Port Arthur. The Japanese destroyed that fleet, too, at the decisive Battle of Tsushima in 1905. It became part of the Japanese national psyche, the decisive battle that stopped the European imperialists. After World War I, Tsarist Russia was replaced as a rival by Great Britain and the United States, who became the focus of Japanese military preparations. As relations between Japan and the West deteriorated, Japan moved to modernize its navy and figure out how it would fight the next war at sea. The Imperial Japanese Navy refused to abandon its long-held idea of the decisive battle like it had enjoyed at Tsushima in 1905 during the Russo-Japanese War. However, the Washington Naval Treaty, a noble attempt by the victorious Allies to prevent another arms race through the limitation of naval construction, ostensibly forced Japan into a set disadvantage against its likely rivals. As a result, Japanese naval strategists looked for creative ways to gain a decisive edge and achieved several breakthroughs. Seeing that, at least in the days before radar, darkness could hide their inferior numbers, the combined fleet, the main ocean-going combat component of the Imperial Japanese Navy, trained relentlessly in night combat. They perfected high-quality optics for night spotting and developed illumination rounds, flares, and float lights that were more reliable and burned more brightly than their American counterparts. The Imperial Japanese Navy's Naval Air Force, known as the Sea Eagles, became the world leader in naval aviation, both in its pursuit of carrier aviation and in its development of seaplanes and seaplane tactics. It was during this period that the Imperial Japanese Navy developed what was arguably the crown jewel and definitely the most dangerous weapon of its surface fleet, the Type 93 torpedo. By far the finest torpedo of its time, the Type 93 was 24 inches in diameter and at 29 feet 6 inches, unusually long. It carried an explosive charge of 1,080 pounds, the largest of its kind. But what made the Type 93 so special was its range. At its high-speed setting of 48 knots, it had a range of 20,000 meters, more than 10 miles. At its slowest speed of 36 knots, it could go an incredible 40,000 meters, more than 20 miles. By comparison, the U.S. Navy's Mark 15 torpedo used by destroyers had a maximum range of just 5,500 meters at its high-speed setting of 45 knots, and a range of 13,700 meters at 26 knots, a speed so slow that it could be outrun by Japanese warships. On top of that, the Mark 15 was powered by steam, which left a trail of bubbles that was easily spotted and seemed overly prone to duds. In contrast, the Type 93 was powered by oxygen, which left no bubbles and little visible wake. The Japanese went to great lengths to conceal the Type 93. Its devastating power would be a rude shock to the U.S. and Royal Navies in the Pacific. Much later, the torpedo's extreme effectiveness and unusual length earned from noted historian Samuel Elliott Morrison the title by which the Type 93 would become famous, Long Lance. The Washington Naval Treaty of 1922 was arguably Japan's last attempt at outwardly restraining its expansionist ambitions in the name of peace. As the treaty was concluded, Emperor Taisho, whose lack of interest in politics had helped Japan agree to the Washington Treaty, was forced from power by health issues. His son, Crown Prince Hirohito, steadily gained more power until December 25, 1925, when Taisho died and the Crown Prince became Emperor of Japan. The new era of Showa, enlightened peace, was proclaimed. Hirohito would use this period of enlightened peace to start two wars. Despite her naval ingenuity, her first aggressive act was in fact on land, with the invasion of China, starting in earnest in 1937. It was never called a war, at least not in Japanese parlance. It was always called an incident, one that was supposed to last a month. Yet it was in this incident that the behavior of the Imperial Japanese Army exhibited some of the most barbaric conduct of the 20th century, including the literal rape of Nanking. Some 20,000 women were raped, most repeatedly, many in front of husbands, fathers, or children, who were murdered when they attempted to intervene. In Nanking alone, some 260,000 civilians were killed. More than a third of the city was left in ruins, and everything of value was shipped to Japan. Ultimately, Japan conquered everything worth conquering in China, its ports, its industrial areas, the majority of its arable land, most of its navigable rivers. Yet it meant nothing. In 1940, the Sea Eagles received a new toy, the Mitsubishi A6M Type 00 Reisen Carrier Fighter Model 11, which would become famous as the Zero. It literally chased what little air power China had from the skies. It still meant nothing. The Chinese would not surrender, could not be made to surrender. As a result, the China incident kept consuming more and more resources, $5 million a day, a staggering sum for that time, while the continuing Japanese atrocities were alienating the very countries on whom Japan depended for import of those resources, such as the United States. Only 10% of the oil Japan used was produced in the home islands. Another 10% came from the Netherlands East Indies. The remainder, 80%, came from the United States. And that flow of oil was in danger of being cut off if relations between Japan and the West continued to deteriorate. And continued to deteriorate they did, as World War II in Europe began. In June 1940, a month after President Roosevelt had moved the Pacific Fleet from San Diego to Pearl Harbor, the U.S. Congress authorized the Two Ocean Navy Act, providing for a massive expansion of the U.S. Navy. In a few years, the U.S. Navy would achieve quantitative superiority to the Imperial Japanese Navy in the Pacific, and any chance of the Japanese assembling the East Asian hegemony that was now the clear goal of Emperor Hirohito would be gone unless immediate action was taken. Tokyo did its calculations. Based on the Two Ocean Navy Act and Japan's own continued naval expansion, Japan's naval strength relative to the U.S. would peak in late 1941. Meanwhile, the Army's continued brutality increased international sympathy for the Chinese, who received a trickle of military support. The Japanese seized northern Indochina to cut the last remaining routes for that support to get to China. The U.S., Britain, and the Dutch government in exile rationalized that Japan was simply trying to cut the Chinese supply line through Indochina and did not suspect that a full-scale invasion of their Far East interests was in the offing. However, in July 1941, the Japanese moved into southern Indochina, seizing a major air complex in and around Saigon. The strategic ramifications of this action were obvious. The Japanese now effectively surrounded the Philippines, with Saigon to the west, Japanese-held Formosa to the north, and the Japanese-held Marshall Islands to the east. Saigon was in range of British Malaya and all-important Singapore, as well as northwest Borneo, which could serve as a gateway into the East Indies. Their intention was clear. The response from Washington was outrage, and on August 1, 1941, Japanese assets were frozen and a total trade embargo on Japan imposed. The British and the Dutch quickly followed suit. Japan and the United States were now at an impasse. Washington would not lift the trade embargo until Japan had withdrawn from both Indochina and China. Japan would not withdraw, as to do so would mean a loss of face, that vague but important Asian concept that remains imperfectly understood in the West, and Japan's inevitable reduction to a second-rate power. So the long-held Japanese ambition to seize the resources of Malaya and the oil-rich Netherlands East Indies was now a national imperative. Becoming self-sufficient through the seizure of Southeast Asia was now more than philosophical. It was essential for national survival. Imperial General Headquarters, the rather informal organization roughly equivalent to the American Joint Chiefs of Staff that grew in wartime to coordinate, in theory, the activities of the Imperial Armies and Navy's general staffs on behalf of the respective services, needed options. The Naval General Staff had been planning an operation to seize Malaya, Borneo, and the Netherlands East Indies for a long time. However, Admiral Yamamoto Isoroku, head of the combined fleet, knew what going to war with the U.S. would mean, a likely catastrophic defeat for Japan. As Yamamoto famously said, "In the first 6 to 12 months of war with the United States and Great Britain, I will run wild and win victory upon victory. But then, if the war continues after that, I have no expectation of success." Nevertheless, he fine-tuned those plans for war. While the Japanese would have the advantage in the short term, they knew they could not match America's industrial and military might in the long term. What they were hoping for was a continuing manifestation of the American political weakness and isolationism that had kept it out of the war so far. Admiral Yamamoto's projection of 6 months was key. The Japanese hoped they could build up their East Asian empire during that time frame, adding the Philippines, Malaya, the East Indies, Siam, already an ally, and Burma, and building up a defensive web of islands including Guam and the Marianas, the Carolines, the Marshalls, the Gilberts, Wake, and New Britain. By the time the United States was mobilized, Japan hoped its new defensive network would make the American public question whether retaking faraway East Asia was worth the cost in lives and in materiel, opening the door to a political settlement that could allow Japan to keep its territorial gains. Of course, that strategy relied on doing nothing to so outrage the American people that they would refuse to listen to any settlement short of Japan's unconditional surrender. And so the plans that Admiral Yamamoto and the Japanese had developed were put into motion. The ships under Vice Admiral Nagumo Chuichi were assembled. 6 aircraft carriers, officially called the First Air Fleet, whose names would become infamous. Akagi, Kaga, Hiryu, Soryu, Shokaku, Suikaku, the Hiei and Kirishima, 2 fast battleships that had been converted from battle cruisers, the Tone and Chikuma, 2 bizarre-looking heavy cruiser seaplane carrier things, and finally the first destroyer flotilla of 8 destroyers, Urakaze, Isokaze, Tanikaze, Amakaze, Kagero, Shiranui, Arare, and Kasumi, led by the light cruiser Abukuma. Referred to as the Japanese Carrier Striking Force in U.S. Navy circles, it was and is more commonly known by the informal name of Kido Butai, Striking Force. They headed to Pearl Harbor and a date with history on December 7, 1941. But even before Kido Butai struck Pearl Harbor, an act that indeed so outraged the American people that they refused to listen to any settlement short of Japan's unconditional surrender, the Japanese began what U.S. military theorists would later call the centrifugal offensive, the conquest of Malaya and the Netherlands East Indies being the prime objectives, but also including the Philippines, Guam and the Marianas, and an outer defense web with the Carolines, the Marshalls, the Gilberts, Wake, and New Britain. The Japanese conquered almost all of them, and they did so even more quickly and at much cheaper cost in men and materiel than their plans had predicted. Japan's drive to seize the Philippines, Malaya, and the Netherlands East Indies was later called the Java Sea Campaign. The key combat engagements included destroying most of the U.S. Far East Air Force on the ground at Clark Field in the Philippines, effectively ceding control of the air to the Japanese for the entire campaign. There was the sinking of the Royal Navy battleship Prince of Wales and battlecruiser Repulse off Malaya by the Japanese Naval Air Force, destroying the most powerful Allied surface ships in the first days of the war, and then there was the Battle of the Java Sea, in which a motley, multinational collection of Allied warships slapped together at the last minute was decisively defeated by the Imperial Japanese Navy. The key component to Japan's victories during this time was air superiority, whether by land-based air or Kido Butai, which topped off this first round of conquests with a rampage through the Indian Ocean, viciously lashing at British bases and ships almost unopposed. Admiral Yamamoto had indeed run wild. But those early victories had come with a heavy, albeit intangible, price. Almost inevitably, the Japanese suffered from a bout of what they called victory disease. The Naval General Staff and the combined fleet thought they simply could not lose. Richard Frank defined the symptoms of victory disease as overextension and dispersion of forces. This was true on a strategic level, but it also manifested itself in arrogance, overconfidence, and sloppiness, all the way down to unit level. The arrogance, sloppiness, and overconfidence showed up regularly at the end of the Java Sea campaign. Just before the Battle of the Java Sea itself, which involved Japanese surface forces escorting a very large convoy of army troops, the commanding Japanese admiral was so contemptuous of Allied opposition that he lagged some 200 miles behind his charges, barely reaching them before the Allies did. Just after the battle, Japanese transports started landing troops in northwest Java, again so contemptuous of Allied opposition that they positioned their forces to block escape rather than protect the invasion transports. The Allied cruisers USS Houston and HMAS Perth, who were indeed trying to escape, got in between the helpless transports and their alleged guards, resulting in a melee in which the Japanese sank both cruisers, but in the process sank four of their own transports, including the flagship of the invasion convoy. The next day, a lone, aged, and damaged American destroyer, the USS Edsel, stumbled into the vaunted Kido Butai south of Java. The carrier's heavy surface escorts, battleships Hiei and Kirishima, and the heavy cruisers' seaplane carriers Tone and Chikuma took the destroyer under fire. However, their shooting was inaccurate, and an enraged Admiral Nagumo resorted to an airstrike to sink the aggravating destroyer. But the Japanese did not see the warning signs, and the victory disease got worse. On January 29, 1942, the Naval General Staff approved an offensive outward from Rabaul to capture Lae, Salamaua, and Port Moresby on New Guinea, and Tulagi in the lower Solomon Islands of the South Pacific. The idea was to eliminate positions from which the Allies could attack Rabaul, which, with its famous harbor, had become the primary Japanese base in the South Pacific. The idea for eliminating threats to Rabaul came from Vice Admiral Inoue Shigeyoshi, whose Fourth Fleet would be handed the job. Highly intelligent and outspoken, Inoue knew his assignment to command the Fourth Fleet, the smallest in the combined fleet with only 18 ships, and covering something of a backwater, was a punishment for opposing the war and doubting the Imperial Japanese Navy's ability to stand up to the U.S. Navy. But Inoue made the most of it. It was his forces that had originally captured Rabaul on January 23, 1942. The invasion of New Guinea started out all right. Admiral Inoue's invasion force moved to Lae and Salamaua, capturing both on March 8th. 2 days later, the anchored invasion force was subject to a surprise attack by more than 100 U.S. Navy carrier aircraft from the aircraft carriers Lexington and Yorktown. Three transports were sunk, a fourth was damaged. Seven other ships were damaged, including light cruiser Yubari and destroyers Asanagi and Yunagi. The loss of the transports was critical, hampering future operations such as the capture of Port Moresby, which had to be postponed. Even more critical was the effect on the Japanese. Admiral Inoue did not like the idea of American aircraft carriers roaming around the South Pacific. He requested his own carriers to aid him in taking Port Moresby. In the meantime, the Naval General Staff had been considering what to do about Australia. On February 7th, the Navy Ministry's Captain Ishikawa Shingo admitted, "There will be no security unless we make Australia the main target in Stage 2 of our basic war plan and annihilate it as a basis for the American counteroffensive." They thought about actually invading Australia, especially after Kido Butai's successful raid on the Northern Territory Australian town and Allied staging area of Darwin in February. But the Army derailed that idea. There were simply not enough troops or transport and supply capacity. The next best thing was to isolate Australia from the United States, cutting communication, sea and air lanes, and possibly forcing it from the war. The Japanese settled on an operation to seize Fiji, Samoa, and New Caledonia in June or early July. They called this Operation FS for Fiji and Samoa. New Caledonia apparently did not warn its own letter. Admiral Yamamoto opposed FS, however, because he believed that occupying Fiji and Samoa would leave Japan dangerously overextended. He had a better idea: occupy Midway and then Hawaii. How that was not overextending Japan was never explained. But Yamamoto believed occupying Midway would compel the U.S. Pacific Fleet to come out for that decisive battle Japanese theorists had long wanted. Following a major debate in the corridors of power in Tokyo, Yamamoto got his way. FS would be delayed until after the Midway operation, and orders were sent out setting FS for July. The Army didn't like it, but after 16 U.S. Army Air Force B-25 Mitchell medium bombers under Lieutenant Colonel James Doolittle successfully bombed Tokyo, an attack obviously launched from American carriers, they could not deny the need to neutralize the Pacific Fleet. Yamamoto wrote to a friend, saying operations until this point had been kind of a children's hour and will soon be over. Now comes the adult's hour. In the meantime, two carriers of Kido Butai, the Shukaku and Zuikaku, along with the light carrier Shoho, were assigned to help Admiral Inoue take Port Moresby and Tulagi. Tulagi was captured on May 3rd. In an action that would later be known as the Battle of the Coral Sea, the U.S. carriers Lexington and Yorktown showed up and attacked Tulagi, sinking a few auxiliaries and the destroyer Kikuzuki. Before the Shokaku and Zuikaku under Rear Admiral Hara Chuichi could take action, the Americans sank the Shoho in spectacular fashion on May 7th, prompting the convoy the carrier was protecting to turn back to Rabaul to avoid sharing the Shoho's fate. It was the first carrier-versus-carrier engagement. The next day, the Japanese and Americans traded airstrikes. The Japanese hit the Yorktown with a bomb and damaged the Lexington, which later had to be scuttled. In exchange, the Japanese suffered heavy damage to the Shokaku and the loss of 77 aircraft. The Shokaku was compelled to return to Japan, while the aircrew combat losses on the Zuikaku compelled her to train a new air group before conducting future operations. Now neither carrier would be available for the main, more crucial operation at Midway. Midway, that most brilliant of Admiral Yamamoto's plans. He could have simply taken his massive fleet and advanced on Midway itself. Instead, he divided his massive armada up into bite-sized pieces, one of which was two-thirds of Kido Butai. Its four operational carriers would attack and neutralize Midway Atoll, paving the way for the invasion force to seize its two islands. The seizure would compel the Pacific Fleet to come out and fight that decisive battle. And yet there was a flaw. The consummate supporter and theorist of air power, Yamamoto appears to have wanted his carriers to attack and weaken the Pacific Fleet in order for his battleships, which were following in another bite-sized piece about 200 miles behind Kido Butai, to arrive and finish off the enemy. Admiral Yamamoto was so sure of himself, the Japanese were so sure of themselves, so stricken with victory disease, that they never developed contingency plans. They lacked the flexibility to adapt to a changing battle situation. Yamamoto thought he had developed the perfect battle plan, yet it was just a theory, untested by battle. Crucially, there was no contingency for the possibility that Midway would put up more of a fight than planned, or the possibility the U.S. Pacific Fleet would be waiting for the Japanese at Midway. Both came to pass, and arrogance, overconfidence, and sloppiness finally caught up with the Imperial Japanese Navy. Continual attacks from the U.S. air squadrons recently based on Midway kept Admiral Nagumo and Kido Butai off balance. Nagumo, never the most creative commander, was torn between attacking Midway and attacking the American carriers, until Douglas SBD Dauntless dive bombers from the Enterprise in Yorktown struck the Akagi, Kaga, and Soryu, whose hangar decks were packed with fully armed and fueled aircraft. The resulting explosions and fire devastated all three carriers and forced their abandonment and scuttling. A counterattack by the Hiryu disabled the Yorktown, but then Dauntless bombers from the Enterprise, Hornet, and Yorktown caught her with fully armed and fueled aircraft on her hangar deck, and Hiryu too became such an inferno that she had to be scuttled. A few days later, the Japanese submarine I-168 managed to finish off the Yorktown and the escorting destroyer Hammond, while, in a bizarre incident, the Japanese cruisers Mikuma and Mogami collided, slowing both down enough for Dauntlesses from the Enterprise and Hornet to sink the Mikuma and severely damage the Mogami. While Midway might be seen as a cure, if an extremely expensive one, to victory disease, it was not, at least not totally. While the Naval General Staff and the combined fleet considered the defeat at Midway disastrous and embarrassing, they did not view it as crippling. They still had a numerical advantage over the U.S. Pacific Fleet in every major category of warships, an advantage in aircraft, and some new carriers in the pipeline. There was no panic, no beating of breasts. They would fight on, which brought the FS operation into the spotlight. After Coral Sea and Midway, it was obvious this timetable was blown, and the operation was delayed 2 months. Enter the Japanese Naval Air Force's 11th Air Fleet of land-based aircraft. Its commander, Admiral Tsukahara Nishizo, submitted an analysis in late June that argued there were not enough Zero fighters for the operation. Moreover, Allied forces in New Guinea were pointed into the Japanese flank for this operation and had to be neutralized. Admiral Yamamoto's chief of staff, Rear Admiral Ugaki Matome, went to Tokyo to press Tsukahara's case with Imperial General Headquarters. Ultimately, FS was canceled. Except they still had that little matter of trying to bolster their defenses against the expected American counterstrike. The solution was to bolster those defenses by fortifying the very same islands that would be needed to pursue the isolation and neutralization of Australia, whenever that took place. It was in this context that Tulagi, a target during the Coral Sea Battle and an expected jumping-off point for FS, provided the next move in this particular game. The Navy's Yokohama Air Group, consisting of seaplanes used to conduct reconnaissance off the Eastern Solomons, was stationed at tiny Tanambogo Island just off Tulagi. The men of the Yokohama, when they got bored or hungry, would sail south across Sea Lark Channel to a much larger island, Garu Kanaru. There they would hunt wild cows. The hunters often included Captain Miyazaki Shigetoshi, commander of the Yokohama, who noticed a plane near Lunga Point on the island's north coast that might make a good airfield. In late June, Miyazaki led Lieutenant Commander Okamura and Admiral Yamada Sariyoshi of the 25th Air Flotilla based in Rabaul in a survey of that plane. They liked what they saw, and so the 11th Construction Unit under Lieutenant Commander Okamura, originally charged with building bases on Midway, were ordered to Garu Kanaru to build this new airfield. So too, Captain Monzen's 13th Construction Unit was sent to Lunga to help build this latest extension of the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. A total of some 2,500 men. Men from the 3rd Kure Special Naval Landing Force were also sent as guards, designated the 81st and 84th Guard Units. The Special Naval Landing Force, often called Japanese Marines, though they could more accurately be described as naval infantry, were tough, well-trained, well-equipped, and already infamous for their brutality. It had taken more than a month. They had worked from opposite ends of the airfield, on the east bank of the Lunga, using pickaxes and shovels. They had met in the middle. Almost. There was still a 197-foot depression there that remained to be filled in and leveled. Nevertheless, on August 7th, the Japanese considered the airfield complete. Not that there wasn't still work to be done. Already 2,624 by 197 feet, the airfield was suitable for the 27 fighters slated to arrive within a week, but more work was needed for the 27 bombers coming at around the same time. With more work still, it could have 45 fighters and 60 bombers by mid-September. Those aircraft would account for only part of the defenses of the new Lunga airfield. The Japanese had placed two 75mm mountain guns, one triple-mount 25mm, two 13mm anti-aircraft guns, and even two radar sets. But they had no one who knew how to operate the 275s. In fact, on-site expertise in handling all the heavy weapons was lacking. For the most part, the weapons were not positioned properly, and in some cases, not even assembled. This didn't seem like a big issue to Captain Monsen, however. Construction was on schedule and was complete. Well, almost. There was still that big hole. Nevertheless, much of the 81st Guard unit was withdrawn. But there were some troubling signs. The Gatarukanaru airfield started attracting bombing attacks by U.S. Army Air Force B-17s. The Yokohama Air Group reported to Rabaul that raids had suddenly increased and were now daily occurrences. Seven B-17s made an attack on July 31st, 10 on August 1st, 11 on August 2nd, 2 on August 3rd, 9 on August 4th, and 5 on August 5th. There were reports that U.S. submarines were moving into the area. Things were not helped when a storm front moved through the area on August 5th and 6th, preventing Japanese reconnaissance planes operating from both Tulagi and Rabaul from searching to the south and east of the Solomons. Then there were the native laborers. The 13th Construction Unit was west of the Lunga River, around the village of Kukum, along with the base headquarters and the 247 members of the 84th Guard Unit, the 1st Company of the 3rd Kurei Special Naval Landing Force. The 11th was east of the river, as was the airfield itself. The laborers were mostly from Korea and Okinawa, but also numerous Melanesian natives, some working voluntarily, others not so much. Except the previous morning, the native workers were nowhere to be found. They had vanished during the night, a development that was reported to Rabaul. Meanwhile, in late July, Lieutenant Commander Ito Harugi of Japanese Radio Intelligence, known as the Owada Communications Group, had detected two new Allied unit call signs in the Southwest Pacific. Both were on the Commander-in-Chief Circuit Series, and both communicated directly with Pearl Harbor. On August 1st, radio direction-finding equipment located one of the call signs in Noumea, French New Caledonia, and the other near Melbourne, Australia. Ito guessed Noumea was for a new South Pacific command, and Melbourne for an Australian or British force. Deducing the Allies were about to start a new offensive in the Solomons or New Guinea, he sent word to Truk, where Admiral Yamamoto was on the battleship Yamato, and to Rabaul as well. His messages were ignored and not passed on to Gatarukanaru or Tulagi, at least not directly. On the morning of August 1st, the 4th Fleet radioed, "According to information received, the enemy's condition is as follows. Enemy is gathering power along the east coast of Australia. You should keep close watch." On the evening of August 6th, the 84th Guard Unit received a bizarre message from the 8th Base Force in Rabaul, stating that the remnants of the 81st Guard Unit, most of which had already been withdrawn from the area and were headed back to Rabaul, should be withdrawn as soon as possible, although, because conditions were increasing the probability of danger, the withdrawal should be postponed. Even so, there was a slowly developing sense of urgency at Lunga. Lieutenant Commander Okamura of the 11th Construction Unit had been urging for weeks the deployment of aircraft to Gatarukanaru despite its lack of a finished runway. On August 5th, the 84th Guard Force joined him in that request. But the request was rejected, as it was believed that the U.S. Navy could not mount a counteroffensive until 1943. Nevertheless, aircraft would be here soon. Three officers of the Yokohama Air Group had visited the airfield on August 5th to inspect the progress. Satisfied that the work was on schedule, they told Captain Monsen that elements of the 25th Air Flotilla would stage into the Lunga Field on August 8th. That was the reason for the visitors on this day. Two staff officers of the unit were coming from Rabaul to inspect the airfield and figure out where to put the aircraft. Maybe they wouldn't notice the big hole. The completion of the airfield had been a cause for celebration for the Japanese. They had been drinking sake and singing in celebration until midnight. Now the men of the 11th got to sleep it off, while the men of the 13th, nursing hangovers no doubt, had to cross the Lunga to make the airfield truly operational. Before heading out, the men of the 13th, such as Captain Monson, performed their morning religious rituals and settled down to breakfast and crushing headaches. There was an explosion. A big one. It came from the kitchen building at Lunga, or, more accurately, what had been the kitchen building, which was now just a pile of rubble. What happened? Another bombing raid? There was no time to consider the question. In quick succession came more blasts, and aircraft making strafing runs on the Lunga base. The Americans were here. Well, he had been expecting visitors. There was panic among the Japanese and the Korean labor force. After carefully considering the questions of whether they wanted to die for their Japanese masters, the Koreans decided, "Not my emperor," and fled. The crack Special Naval Landing Force troops, with a well-earned reputation for never surrendering, turned their tails and fled. Captain Monson reported his men had gotten out of hand. Some fortunate ones fled to a coconut grove, from which Monson would try to figure out a way to defend Garokunaru, the island known in the west as Guadalcanal. The time was 6:14 a.m. It was, as Petty Officer Second Class Kaneda Sankichi of the 3rd Kurei Special Naval Landing Force called it, the beginning of hell. Chapter 1. Fighting the Problem. At 5:19 a.m., more than 2 hours after battle stations had sounded, a new command post came to life on the transport USS Macaulay. The Wacky Mac, as the Macaulay was known, was the flagship of Rear Admiral Richmond Kelly Turner, commanding the ships of an amphibious invasion force, the first such force for the U.S. in World War II. Indeed, the first amphibious invasion since 1898. The U.S. Navy would not have done this, because too many senior officers believed it simply could not be done, but for the iron will of the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet, Admiral Ernest J. King. After Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt believed he needed new people in place to deal with the new reality of war, people who were fighters, not politicians. King was certainly no politician. The man described by official U.S. Navy historian Samuel Elliott Morrison as a hard man with little sense of humor, had made few friends ascending the ranks, but had done enough to be noticed by the right people. Pearl Harbor had convinced President Roosevelt to replace husband Kimmel with Chester Nimitz as Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, whose acronym CINCPAC was usually verbalized as SINCPAC. Admiral Thomas C. Hart was already Commander-in-Chief of the Asiatic Fleet, CINCAF, verbalized as SINCAF, and indeed most of what had been the Asiatic Fleet was now sunk. King himself had been Commander-in-Chief of the Atlantic Fleet, C-I-N-C-L-A-N-T, verbalized as Sinkland, before he was named Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet, C-I-N-C-U-S, verbalized as Sinkus. King quickly decided he would rather not have all the officers and sailors fighting the war at sea under his naval command saying Sinkus. The new acronym for the same title would be Cominch. The 63-year-old admiral would become a somewhat controversial figure. A trained aviator, King was brilliant, determined, and arrogant. Historian William Toohey would say King believed he could do any job in the U.S. Navy better than anyone else, and would run the Navy with an iron fist and no velvet glove. The eminent Guadalcanal historian Richard B. Frank describes him this way. Besides intelligence and dedication, one other pillar supported King's professional reputation. His toughness. He regarded exceptional performance of duty as the norm, and evinced insensitivity or even callousness to his subordinates, upon whom he also frequently exercised his ferocious temper. But if King proved harsh with subordinates, he was no toady to superiors. Those who fell short of King's standards found he could be hostile, tactless, arrogant, and sometimes disrespectful or even insubordinate. According to Morrison, Admiral King knew he was respected rather than liked by the Navy. He was hated by such a distinguished cast of characters as Secretary of War Henry Stimson, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, Chief of the Imperial General Staff Field Marshal Sir Alan Brooke, and Royal Navy Admiral Sir Andrew Cunningham. None came close to the opinion of General Dwight Eisenhower. The man who could make friends with pretty much everyone once said, "One thing that might help win this is to get someone to shoot King. He's the antithesis of cooperation, a deliberately rude person, which means he's a mental bully." Why? Because King wanted to press the Pacific War against the Japanese, not drain it to support the fight against Germany. Nevertheless, Admiral King was appointed to the renamed Cominch on December 30, 1941. Why? Although he may have been dark and humorless, King had a can-do philosophy. He approached the Pacific War with the idea of make the best of what you have. There must be no tendency to excuse incomplete readiness for war on the premise of future acquisition of trained personnel or modernized material. Personnel shall be trained and rendered competent. Existing material shall be maintained and utilized at its maximum effectiveness at all times. With a thin reed of resources available in the Pacific at this time, it was an essential philosophy. The man with whom Admiral King would be working in the Pacific would be Admiral Nimitz, the new commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet. Nimitz was almost King's alter ego. Every bit as brilliant as King, Nimitz was in some ways a contradiction, a soft-spoken Texan almost without ego. Quiet, thorough, and thoughtful, a natural diplomat, was how Toohey would later describe him. Nimitz was loyal to his subordinates and was good at avoiding the poisonous personal relations that seemed to follow King. Morrison described him as having the prudence to wait through a lean period, to do nothing rash for the sake of doing something. He had the capacity to both organize a fleet and a vast war theater, the tact to deal with sister services and allied commands, the leadership to weld his own subordinates into a great fighting team, the courage to take necessary risks, and the wisdom to select from a variety of intelligence and opinions the correct strategy to defeat Japan. That was with the benefit of hindsight. Things looked different in those last days of 1941 and early days of 1942. The demands of the war and the politics involved exhausted even Nimitz. He wrote to his wife, "I'll be lucky to last 6 months." Together, King and Nimitz would have to wrestle with the big philosophical issue dominating these hard early days of the Pacific War. Identify the fine line between making the best of what you have and doing something rash for the sake of doing something. Indeed, early on, Admiral King did not trust Nimitz and tried to steamroll him. But soft-spoken did not mean weak, and Nimitz stood up to him. King backed down, and the two ultimately worked well together, especially at finding that line. As Japan swept across Southeast Asia and the Pacific, President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill were having their first secret conference, codenamed Arcadia. It was at Arcadia that the Europe First policy was firmly established by the U.S. and Britain. Nevertheless, the Pacific was not to be neglected, and the Allies were not to remain passive in defense of this theater. It was at Arcadia where the ill-fated organization known as ABDICOM, American, British, Dutch, Australian Command, was formed to pool Allied resources in the defense of Malaya and the Netherlands East Indies in what has been called the Java Sea Campaign. It was from Arcadia that on December 31, 1941, Admiral King issued his first substantive orders to Admiral Nimitz. The Pacific Fleet was first to hold the line at Hawaii Midway and protect the lines of communication with the West Coast. Second, and only in small degree less important, the fleet was to protect the lines of communication with Australia. Even though the agreement out of Arcadia was very clearly Europe first for resources and efforts, Admiral King got in a few helpful lines about the war against Japan. The carefully worded and intentionally vague declaration said efforts in the Pacific would involve maintaining only such positions in the Pacific theater as will safeguard vital interests and deny to Japan access to raw materials vital to her continuous war effort while we are concentrating on the defeat of Germany. Vital interests was conspicuously left undefined, though the term was used a second time as a title for a tiny section, the safeguarding of vital interests in the Eastern Theater. 18. The security of Australia, New Zealand, and India must be maintained, and Chinese resistance supported. Secondly, points of vantage from which an offensive against Japan can eventually be developed must be secured. This authorization to seize points of vantage from which an offensive against Japan can eventually be developed was added at Admiral King's insistence. The declaration also identified main sea routes which must be secured, including the Pacific routes from the United States and the Panama Canal to Alaska, Hawaii, Australia, and the Far East. Securing those routes required holding and capturing essential sea bases, which included Hawaii and Samoa. There were also main air routes which must be secured, which included the U.S. to Australia via Hawaii, Christmas Island, Canton, Palmyra, Samoa, Fiji, and New Caledonia. This required securing essential air bases, including Hawaii, Christmas Island, Palmyra, Canton, Samoa, Fiji, New Caledonia, and Townsville. Allied action in the Pacific seemed to be severely limited by this document, but Admiral King had a lawyer's eye. For instance, Australia was some 7,000 miles from San Francisco. As Vice Admiral George Dyer pointed out in discussing King's seemingly limited options, a straight line on a Mercator chart from San Francisco in California to Townsville passes just south of the island of Hawaii and just south of Guadalcanal Island in the Solomons. In Admiral King's belief, the Japanese should not be permitted to impinge on this line if the line of communications from Hawaii to Australia through Samoa, Fiji, and the New Hebrides was to be secure. Did that mean in order to secure the air and sea lane to Australia, under the Arcadia Declaration, Guadalcanal must be secured? The New Hebrides? One could make the argument that it did. That is how all these locations would come up again and again, as King looked for ways to wedge his allowances under the Arcadia Declaration ever wider to position U.S. forces in the Pacific for not just defense, but offensive operations as well. Under pre-existing defense plans, Admiral King was able to send small garrisons to Palmyra, almost 1,000 miles south of Pearl Harbor, and to American Samoa, another 1,300 miles toward New Zealand. South of Palmyra, on the route to Samoa, were Canton and Christmas Islands, which the Army under Arcadia garrisoned with 1,500 and 2,000 troops, respectively. Things started to get strained when the issue of French New Caledonia came up. New Caledonia was free French, with strategically important nickel and chrome deposits. With France under Nazi occupation and a Vichy government, it was almost defenseless. Australia had agreed to garrison it, but was stretched too thin to do so beyond a company of commandos. Aside from these 300 Australians, there was a local force of native troops of dubious effectiveness. New Caledonia could not withstand a major Japanese effort. With New Caledonia specifically listed on the Arcadia Declaration, Admiral King forced the army to scrape up something to defend it. They gathered loose units totaling some 17,000 troops, including the Army Air Force's 67th Pursuit Squadron, and threw them in a secret, heavily guarded convoy from New York to Noumea, where they arrived in March. The army also scraped together a 4,000-man garrison for Bora Bora, where King established a fueling base. While trying to secure these supply lines, King prodded Nimitz to carry on a sort of naval guerrilla warfare against exposed Japanese positions. On February 12th, he told Nimitz, "A strong and comprehensive offensive is to be launched soon against exposed enemy naval forces and the positions he is now establishing in the Bismarcks and Solomons." 3 days later came a reminder. Current operations of the Pacific Fleet, because of existing threat, should be directed toward preventing further advance of enemy land airplane base development in the direction of Suva and Noumea. Then on February 26th came yet another reminder. "Our current tasks are not merely protective, but also offensive, where practicable." In other words, make the best of what he had. It was this nudging that resulted in an attempted raid by the carrier Lexington on Rabaul on February 20th that was aborted when Japanese flying boats from the Yokohama Air Group spotted the carrier, spooking it enough to withdraw, but not before having to fight off an attack by twin-engine Mitsubishi G4M Type 1 land attack planes. The Allies called this aircraft the Betty, of the 4th Air Group. Fighter pilot Lieutenant Edward H. "Butch" O'Hare was credited with shooting down 5 bombers in 6 minutes. This made him the Army Air Force's first flying ace and earned him the Medal of Honor and his name on an airport in Chicago. Admiral King's pestering also brought the successful attack on the Japanese invasion force off Lae and Salamaua on March 10th. The leadership of the U.S. Army, in the form of General George C. Marshall and Army Air Force General Henry H. Happ Arnold, was committed to the Europe First policy. Taking much of their cue from General Eisenhower, Marshall and Arnold were determined to quash any offensive actions in the Pacific and not send any reinforcements there, to set a limit to future movements of Army forces into the Pacific, and find a basis for increasing the rate at which Army forces will be moved across the Atlantic became, during February and March, the chief concern of General Marshall and his advisers on the War Department staff, and the focus of their discussion of future plans with the Army Air Forces and the Navy. Nevertheless, the continuing Japanese advance that imperiled Australia obliged President Roosevelt to send Army troops there, which meant a supply line for those troops had to be maintained and protected, and an American public still enraged over Pearl Harbor and filled with unbridled fear, hatred, and distrust toward Japan meant that a passive posture in the Pacific was politically unacceptable to Roosevelt. In Admiral King's estimation, that advance meant the Japanese would soon conquer positions to threaten the lanes through Samoa, Fiji, and New Caledonia with air attacks. On February 18th, King suggested Tonga Tabu in the Tonga Islands would be the ideal location for the principal operating naval base in the South Pacific, while aircraft there would provide mutual support for those on Fiji and Samoa. King also suggested taking Efati in the New Hebrides, which would deny a stepping stone to the Japanese if they moved south from Rabaul, and provide a strong point from which a step-by-step general advance could be made through the New Hebrides, Solomons, and Bismarcks. General Marshall did not like that. 6 days later, he wrote back, "It is my desire to do anything reasonable which will make offensive action by the fleet practicable. But, A, what is the general scheme or concept of operations that the occupation of these additional islands is designed to advance? Are the measures taken purely for protection of a line of communications, or is a step-by-step general advance contemplated? B, what islands will be involved? C, what army troops, particularly air, will your proposal eventually involve? D. Your proposal contemplates the employment of army forces as occupational troops. Has the question of the availability of the Marines been fully explored?" Marshall went on to state that American operations in the South Pacific must, for several reasons, be limited to the strategic defensive, so far as air and ground forces were concerned. He concluded, "I therefore feel that if a change in basic strategy, as already approved by the combined chiefs of staff, is involved, the entire situation must be reconsidered before we become involved more seriously in the buildup of army ground and air garrisons in the Pacific Islands." It was a flat refusal to provide any help behind a thin passive-aggressive veil. But Admiral King was deft. He answered each of Marshall's questions with his, frankly, more offensively-minded concepts of our future Pacific endeavor. At a March 2nd meeting of the newly formed Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral King handed out a memorandum detailing his proposal. King summarized his proposal with 9 words, "Hold Hawaii, support Australasia, drive northwestward from New Hebrides. The general scheme or concept of operations is not only to protect the lines of communication with Australia," he wrote, "but in doing so to set up strong points from which a step-by-step general advance can be made through the New Hebrides, Solomons, and Bismarck Archipelago." From this proposal, King said he needed 2, maybe 3 army divisions, and maybe 8 groups of aircraft. By this time, Singapore had fallen only a few weeks earlier. Defeat in the Battle of the Java Sea had spelled the end of the Allies in the Netherlands' East Indies. President Roosevelt needed something, anything, on which to hang some hope. Admiral King's proposal did just that. King was the man with a plan, which was more than anyone else had at that time. Roosevelt gave his tacit approval. However, by now the Joint Chiefs could not even agree if keeping the lines of communication open to Australia was necessary, as had been contemplated in the Arcadia Declaration. On February 28, 1942, General Eisenhower told General Marshall, "The United States' interest in maintaining contact with Australia and in preventing further Japanese expansion to the southeastward is apparent, but they are not immediately vital to the successful outcome of the war. The problem is one of determining what we can spare for the effort in that region, without seriously impairing performance of our mandatory tasks. As a result, Roosevelt now prohibited further reinforcements for the Pacific. The Army had convinced him to give everything to Europe and nothing to the Pacific. Touring the Pacific, General Arnold later said, "It was impossible not to get the impression that the Navy was determined to carry on the campaign in that theater, and determined to do it with as little help from the Army as possible. The Army's refusal to provide additional units to the Pacific or to agree to offensive action softened when General Douglas MacArthur was rescued from the fall of the Philippines in March 1942. When the Japanese first attacked the Philippines on December 8, 1941, MacArthur, already a national hero, demonstrated his unique leadership style. When he was good, he was very, very good. When he was bad, he was horrid. After long predicting the Japanese could not attack until spring of 1942, MacArthur had refused to consider evidence that a Japanese attack was in fact imminent. Then, after being informed of the Pearl Harbor attack, MacArthur disappeared for the next several hours, the first hours of the war, apparently shell-shocked that his predictions were actually wrong. Most of his aircraft were destroyed on the ground at the Clark Field Base Complex, due largely to MacArthur's willful violation of orders. The result was an inability to contest Japanese control of the air over the Philippines and later the Netherlands East Indies. MacArthur refused to position supplies on the Bataan Peninsula for a protracted campaign because the idea of withdrawing there was defeatist, so that when he ultimately did withdraw there, his troops had neither the ammunition nor the food for prolonged resistance. After the situation in the Philippines went south, Roosevelt ordered MacArthur to go south too, all the way to Australia, leaving the troops he had so poorly served behind. But MacArthur was still a national hero, with a formidable public relations machine that covered up much of his horrid performance and made him a domestic political threat to Roosevelt. Keeping him on the sidelines was out of the question. Now the Army was interested in reinforcing the Pacific for an offensive led by Douglas MacArthur. Like a protagonist in his own movie, MacArthur needed something interesting to do, which brought up the question of whether the Pacific needed to be like Europe under General Eisenhower and have one theater commander. Douglas MacArthur was the obvious choice, to the Army at any rate. To the Navy, MacArthur was the one who had constantly berated the Asiatic fleet and its commander Admiral Hart as not being worthy of the name, allowed the Japanese to completely destroy their base at Cavite, then, to top it off, blamed the fleet for the collapsing situation in the Philippines. Finding MacArthur's performance more horrid than very, very good, and rightly believing MacArthur knew nothing about sea power, Admiral King, with the full backing of the Navy leadership, vowed that MacArthur would never have operational command of the Pacific Fleet. The Army believed MacArthur bore no responsibility for the disaster in the Philippines, that public relations machine at work. They would not agree to command by a Navy admiral. To break the impasse, on March 9th, the Joint Chiefs created two command areas of the Pacific Theater. One, a Southwest Pacific Command, encompassed the Philippines, the Netherlands East Indies, Australia, the Solomon Islands, and adjoining ocean areas. Most of these were not currently under Allied control. It would be up to its commander, General MacArthur, to retake them. As part of the command, MacArthur even got his own little navy to abuse, just as he had Admiral Hart and the Asiatic Fleet. And he did. At his new headquarters in Melbourne, MacArthur told a reporter, "The best navy in the world is the Japanese Navy, a first-class navy. Then comes the British Navy. The U.S. Navy is a fourth-class navy, not even as good as the Italian Navy." Nimitz got the rest, as part of a Pacific Ocean area, and, like General MacArthur, he reported to his respective service chief on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who would be conducting this Pacific War by committee. Nimitz's Pacific Ocean area was further divided into three regions, north, central, and south, with boundaries at 40 degrees north latitude and the equator. Admiral Nimitz would directly command the first two, but the new South Pacific Command for the area south of the equator would have to be handed off to a subordinate, with Vice Admiral Robert L. Garmley, who had just finished his term as Special Naval Observer in London, eventually selected. On April 18th, while Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle conducted an operation initiated by Admiral King in leading 16 B-25 Mitchell medium bombers from the deck of the aircraft carrier Hornet in a bombing attack on Japan that left little damage but humiliated the Japanese military establishment, King issued orders to Admiral Garmley that, as Garmley later recalled them, read like a summons to jury duty. You have been selected to command the South Pacific Force and South Pacific Area. You will have a large area under your command and a most difficult task.